Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Lilydale Radio, featuring topics about spiritualism, mediumship, healing, spirituality, and the Lilydale Assembly, the world's largest center for the religion, philosophy, and science of spiritualism. This is Lilydale Radio.
We are always looking for ways to connect with the divine source, and there are ancient forms of mediumship and miracles that can inspire us on our spiritual journey. Welcome to Wednesdays with Willa. I am your host, Willa White, and this is my weekly podcast show that airs on Wednesday mornings at 10 a.m. Eastern on my Facebook page, Willa White Medium. You can also tune into the show on blogtalkradio.com/lilydaleradio. That's a listen-only feature podcast, and it's part of the Lilydale family radio shows. So you can tune in throughout the week to various shows and different topics. On my show, I typically feature a special guest, and we discuss a topic relating to either spiritualism, mediumship, healing, faith, family, or more. And you can also find this on my YouTube channel. It gets uploaded later on, as well as the Lilydale Assembly Facebook page. So lots of ways to tune in. If you want to be notified as to when I go live for these podcasts and other features, please go ahead and like and share and follow and subscribe and all of those good things. And when an event pops up to notify you of a special speaker or guest that's coming on the show, make sure that you mark that you're interested in, or that you're going, so that if I provide you additional information or prior podcast shows, I do link them in that event so that you get some bonus material. So I am so excited to have on my show today Leonard George. Thanks for being on the show today, Leonard.
Well, thank you for having me, for sure.
Leonard is a wonderful man, and I'm excited to explain a little bit about his background. You're going to really enjoy a lot of his perspective. I know I do, and my listeners and viewers are going to get a lot out of this particular show, because this is about theurgy and spiritualism and the combination of those things. Before I tell you what theurgy is, I'm going to share that Leonard George is an author, a retired university professor of psychology, a researcher, a clinician, a broadcaster, and a world traveler. Leonard has lectured in Lilydale during the summer symposium, and he continues to shine a new light on the paranormal and mystical experiences of antiquity and modern times. So you can see he's going to be a perfect expert on the show to talk about theurgy and spiritualism. Let's take it away. What is theurgy?
There's the million-dollar question to start us. Hi to all of our viewers. Well, there's a short answer to that question, and there's an interesting answer, so I'll give you both. The short answer is theurgy is a word in ancient Greek, and it literally means divine action. Now, over time, this word has meant or has been interpreted as meaning a whole lot of different things. So it really depends on who you ask. But the interesting answer that really helps us get this in focus is to go back to the ancient Mediterranean world and start with the great tradition of oracle sites. For about 1,000 years, there were many places around the Mediterranean world and even a little beyond that had the reputation of being locations where the boundary between the human world and the divine world was exceptionally thin. And so people would make pilgrimages to these places, and of course temples would be built. And specialists would be there, priestesses, priests, sibyls, at these sites, who would act as intermediaries between the humans and the divine. And there were many of these. The famous one that most people know about was Delphi in Greece, but there are many others, Didyma in what is now Turkey, the Serapeion in Alexandria, Egypt, were two more that are quite well known, but there were many of these. And the popularity of the oracle sites in the ancient Mediterranean world waxed and waned over time. Once we arrive at the beginning of the 2nd century CE, or the 2nd century AD, as we used to say, in the Roman Empire, this was a low point for the oracle tradition. In fact, Plutarch, who was one of the folks at Delphi, even speculated that the spirits that linked the gods with the human mediums were dying, and so the link was weakening. Then something happened that's very mysterious, and we still don't really understand it very well. During the 2nd century, there was what's called the final flowering of the oracles. There was a sudden massive uptick in the activity of the oracles. And even more interestingly, all of the major oracles started receiving and transmitting very similar messages. The way I think about this is, if you think of the oracle sites as like radio telescopes, these dishes that are scanning the heavens trying to pick up signals, it's almost as if all of a sudden all of the dishes of the oracle sites were picking up the same signal from outer space. Very, very strange. This had never happened before. And the content of this message, this transmission, was remarkable as well. It wasn't answering questions like, should I invade my neighbor or who stole my sheep, you know, which could have been questions brought to the oracle before. It was a spiritual message that was coming through. Mm-hmm. One scholar even referred to it as the new theology, this message coming through. And roughly it had three parts. The first part was the idea that the gods were not so far away. It'd be very easy to think of the divine world, the gods way off on Mount Olympus or something, so far from me, a shepherd or a philosopher or whatever, but the message was, no, the gods are actually very close, the presence of the gods. The second part of the three-part message had to do with divine unity, the notion that the deepest or highest level of reality, all is one. Now, this idea wasn't new. It certainly didn't start in the 2nd century. Philosophers have been talking about it for a long time. But this was a more sort of universal highlighting of this notion of divine unity. And the third part of the three-part message that was coming through was the idea that these divine realities were actually quite available to everyone. So the stage was set for something that happened in about the middle of the 2nd century, that changed everything. It changed the ancient world and potentially ripples to this particular day. And here we're talking about the origin of the word theurgy. Around the middle of the 2nd century, text appeared and began circulating through the ancient world. We call this text the Chaldean Oracles, a collection of writings. And the word Chaldean, by the way, looks like C-H-A-L-D-A-N, Chaldean Oracles. This text appeared, began circulating, and started attracting a great deal of attention. Soon people were saying that the Chaldean Oracles was the pinnacle, the Mount Everest, so to speak, of the whole ancient oracle tradition. Wow. Such was its profundity. Yeah. Not only that, it was the pinnacle of the tradition of ancient philosophy. Philosophy, the tradition of seeking truth through questioning. Mm. Not only that, people regarded the Chaldean oracles as the pinnacle of the ancient tradition of the mysteries, self-transformation through contact with the gods. So this was a great big splash that these oracles actually made. And we believe that the word theurgy was first used in the text of the Chaldean oracles. Mm. Where do the Chaldean oracles come from? We don't know for sure. but evidence points to one of the oracle sites, specifically the temple of Zeus Belos in the city of Apamea in Syria. At the time, Syria was a province of the Roman Empire, and it seems to have come from there. There are various clues. I won't get into it. There are more clues suggesting that there is an individual by the name of Julian who was the transmitter of the Chaldean oracles. Now, you have to be a bit careful, because if you nose around ancient history, you'll find a bunch of Julians,
right.
And the most famous one is probably the Roman emperor named Julian.
Yes.
But he was a couple of centuries later. Interestingly, he was a theurgist, but that's not the one we're talking about. This fellow, it's thought that when the transmission occurred, he was quite young, possibly a boy. And so one plausible scenario is that this boy, Julian, was meditating perhaps in the temple in Apamea, and he experienced a visitation.
Mm.
The spirit of the philosopher Plato came to him.
Wow.
Now, Plato, the very fifth, anyone's ever heard of an ancient philosopher, they probably know the name Plato. Plato had died nearly 500 years earlier. But according to some ancient accounts, the spirit of Plato came to the young Julian in some kind of meditative state and said, get ready. Someone else is coming through, and you better get ready for this. And so it really reminds me within spiritualism of the notion of the control spirit very often.
Yeah.
Famous mediums, perhaps the famous medium named Willa, I don't know, has certain entities that act as sort of openers of the door or introducers of other spirits. And so Plato, big deal, the spirit of Plato himself came through and said, get ready, here comes someone else. Now it turned out that what happened next was not just someone else, it was a goddess. The goddess Hecate, ancient Greek goddess, very well known. She's the one, if you know ancient art, she's often portrayed with a pair of torches, and she guided the goddess Demeter when her daughter Persephone was kidnapped and taken off into the underworld. Persephone guided Demeter into the underworld to find her kidnapped daughter. And so this was the goddess that came through the boy Julian, and he began to utter, and someone took it all down. In fact, it's thought that it was Julian's father who actually took it down. Just to confuse the matters further, Julian's father's name was Julian. So track the Julians. But at any rate, the text that the young Julian uttered, we believe, is the text of the Chaldean Oracles. And the Chaldean Oracles describes the theory and practice of theurgy.
Beautiful.
Which, again, kind of crystallizes this so-called new theology that started coming through. You could almost regard it as a kind of do-it-yourself oracle. You don't have to go trekking off to Delphi or Didyma anymore to consult an expert.
Yeah.
If you master theurgy, then, in fact, you yourself are directly connected to the divine current in its manifestation in the world of the senses. And that is the divine action. The word theurgy has these two roots, theos, meaning divine or about God or the gods, and urgia, which basically refers to the notion of action. And so the mature theurgist, the enlightened theurgist, is someone who's in a condition in which their behaviors and also their mental activity, their thoughts and feelings, are all completely, perfectly aligned with the divine current as it manifests in the world, and that is, and as it yearns to return to the primordial unity. So it's a circuit, and the theurgist is the element that completes the circuit. So you have the divine outflow from the one into the many, and then all things yearn to return to their origin, and so that's the other aspect of it. And the theurgist, I'm making a circle because I often see it that way, and a little wee person standing at the bottom, so they are receiving, participating in the divine outflow, in effect participating in the creation of the cosmos.
Right.
And the yearning, the curiosity the sense that there's more to everything than appearance is the beginning of that return. So we have our creativity, our curiosity.
Right.
These things taken as sacred activities,
mm-hmm.
in a nutshell, is what I would say is the core of the theurgical insight. So a grand vision, don't you think?
Absolutely. And I love how it holds that understanding of being co-creator with the universe. And I love your explanation of this circuit, this completion of circuit, and that it lights us up with the divine light, and that it's through that divine action.
That's it. And, of course, most of us don't know how to do this, at least we think we don't know how to do this, and so that's where the details of the teaching of theurgy come in.
Yes.
Now for the bad news, the Kaldean oracles as a text has not survived. All we have are fragments, and they're scattered through ancient literature and quotations, etc. But scholars have worked hard to collect these fragments and try and put them together. Here's the question. Even if we had the Kaldean oracles in its complete text, I think it would still probably be a very peculiar and profound and difficult work. Because to me, all great spiritual works actually are like that.
Yeah.
They're so full of meaning. They're so full of many, many different possibilities that there's space for growth. There's space for exploration.
Mm-hmm.
And so we can almost say, oh, great, we don't have the complete text. We only have fragments. It's even more ambiguous. Obviously, the danger is you make of it what you want, and that's the pitfall. But the upside of it is that you use your intuition and you don't fall into another pitfall, which is trying to or pretending that you yourself can do it exactly the same as someone in the second century. Because even if we had the complete text and all the details, that
mm-hmm.
would be impossible
mm-hmm.
because we're not in the second century.
Right.
But there is a spirit to the whole thing
mm-hmm.
that I think
mm-hmm.
is reconstructible. And in the spirit of theurgy, I do think we can connect with this. And certainly for those who like puzzles and challenges, there's nothing deeper than studying the Kaldean oracles, any other material that actually came out of it. Because as I say, many people in late antiquity were inspired by theurgy, by the revelation of the oracles, and then evolved it in various ways. And so it's very rich.
It is very rich. And it's very exciting to hear you describe that. And I know I'm putting together those things in my mind now, and how it relates to my own mediumship and connection with the divine spirit. So wonderful. You're doing a great job, Leonard. Keep on going.
I'm just letting it flow through.
You are. Look at you.
That's what happens.
You channel.
That's what happens, yeah. But yes, and of course, I think that makes perfect sense to see the parallel here.
Yeah.
And even in the origin story, one thing that is striking about theurgy is that we using metaphors like a circuit or a current, and you can think of that in modern terms as kind of like electricity,
mm-hmm.
but even in the oracles themselves, it's electricity. That's the metaphor that's used,
mm-hmm.
because the imagery is that of lightning.
Mm-hmm.
The idea that the current that flows from the one to the many and returns to the one is often described as a flowing flame or living fire, and even literally as lightning. And so it's a fascinating thing to ponder, the idea of a living spark, a living energy. This isn't just New Age modern language that's being applied to the past. This is actually found in the ancient texts, these ideas. So I think the influence goes the other direction, frankly.
Yeah.
I think the idea of lightning as a representation, as an accurate representation of some of these contact experiences,
mm-hmm.
Has persisted through the ages, not just in the age of our electricity.
Yeah, it has. That divine spark carries on, even in the Sistine Chapel, right? that connection point that happens within all of us, that we carry that divine spark.
Yeah, and it's a very fun thing to visualize the great hand of God and the hand of Adam, and what in between, the space in between, is theurgy.
There we go. There we go. We have that. And then when you think of how we have electromagnetic energy, that we are vessels of those things and users of that energy, and that courses through us, it all makes sense.
Well, it all makes sense. You caught on so quickly. It's complicated and mysterious, but again, for those who are open and intuitive about it, there's something very familiar about it, isn't it?
Oh, absolutely.
It's so exotic when we kind of ground it. And one of the things when we think about a circuit or electricity is we could think about that impersonally as a sort of force or power, and that's one way to look at it. But in the ancient theurgy, it was clear that we're talking not just about a living fire, a living electricity, a living circuit, but as something that is personified. So it's not just impersonal. And here we bring in arguably the greatest theurgist, at least that we know about, of ancient times, a fellow with the exotic name Iamblichus. And for the next spelling bee, that is spelled I-A-M-B-L-I-C-H-U-S, Iamblichus. It's a Syrian name because Iamblichus was from Syria. In fact, he lived much of his life in Apamea. But we don't think he was born there, but he was there. And his name literally in the old Syriac language means the God rules or the divine rules. And Iamblichus was an outstanding mind. He lived from roughly the middle of the 3rd century into the early 4th century. Renowned philosopher and theurgist. And fortunately, some of his writings have survived. Unfortunately, his 20-volume massive work on the Chaldean oracles has disappeared. I hope a copy turns up.
Yeah.
As far as we know, nothing left of that. So once again, we're dealing with fragments. But he cast a very profound light on the whole matter. But not surprisingly, because the spirit of Plato started the ball rolling, the worldview of theurgy is very amenable to a Platonic interpretation.
Mm-hmm.
And Iamblichus was a master of the Platonic philosophy. And so he was really able to amplify theurgy using Platonic kinds of notions.
Mm-hmm.
But why I brought Iamblichus in at this point is that one of the very interesting aspects of this that he clarifies is the notion of contact with spiritual entities.
Yes.
As an important part of theurgy.
Mm-hmm.
Now, it's clear it was from the beginning, but Iamblichus had access to the complete text, which we don't, and probably other important sources as well. And so he paints the picture of a living universe that is also a personal living universe. And it's almost as if the stages of outflow and return are personified as different types of spiritual beings. So as you circulate as a theurgist, you encounter different spiritual entities, and you better know how to handle it, because there are opportunities and dangers associated with these encounters. And there are a couple of different versions of how Iamblichus mapped this out. One of the simpler versions is that he said, here we have the human souls are down here, here we have the gods up here. And remember, we're talking polytheism here, so we're talking about the plurality of ancient gods, and there is this gap. We can think of this as the return part of the cycle, by the way.
Mm-hmm.
And so the gods reach out to us. They reach down and manifest in the form of these beings called, and we have to be careful here, called in Greek, the daimons, not demons, but daimons. I like to use the ancient Greek word because it's not the word demon. Some scholars actually use the word demon there, but that potentially is quite misleading for obvious reasons, because we're not talking about evil spirits. We're talking about a kind of more immediate manifestation of the divine. So we have the gods, they reach down toward the human souls in the form of daimons. The human souls, certain of them reach up in the form of what Iamblichus calls the heroes. So you have the gods reaching down through the daimons, the souls reaching up through the heroes, zap, right? And when that is bridged, the text says, in one of Iamblichus's writings, is that the daimons and the heroes forge a bridge between the gods and the souls. And that brings forth the communion of all things indivisible. And I've always cherished that phrase, the communion of all things, because that's where it's at with this. Everything comes from that source. Everything yearns to return to that source. And so we're all kin in that particular way. That kinship becomes conscious with this forging of the bridge. So in this version, we have gods, daimons, heroes, and souls. Second version, also from Iamblichus, slightly more elaborate, is we have the gods and the souls, but there are five intermediary classifications. We have the heroes. We have these creatures called archons. There are actually two kinds. We won't get into the details. The daimons, and also angels and archangels before we get to the gods. This surprises some people.
Yeah.
I thought angels were Christian or Jewish, and what's it doing with gods in it? But of course, the word angel, the Greek word angelos, simply means messenger. And so, yes, there were pagan angels and pagan archangels. Here we have right in the text of Iamblichus. And so this is just a more articulated version of the same notion. But again, we have to bear in mind that for the theurgists, and hopefully for us, this isn't just speculation, metaphysics, theoretical. At least potentially these are experiences. And so... Iamblichus is trying to be practical here. What do you do if you're in a contemplative state and there's a manifestation of some kind? It would be good if you knew at which level the manifestation was coming from, because your mission, should you decide to accept it, is to try to develop a mature relationship with this entity. There are no evil spirits in this business. The daimons are not demons. They're extremely troublesome. But the whole point is not to chase him away. The point is to establish a mature relationship with this personified, shall we say, step in the ladder. And so a chunk of the surviving writings of Iamblichus has always fascinated me, where he lays this out. And in fact, if you take this old text, you can make it into a diagram, a kind of matrix, because he takes all seven types of spiritual entity and he describes each one in terms of 20 characteristics. And so you can actually make a 7x20 matrix, and it can get very intriguing in that regard. But again, this is for practical purposes. If something manifests to you, you look at qualities of luminosity and qualities of movement and how it affects you in various ways. You can kind of get a sense, is this a daimon? Is it a sublunary archon? Is this an archangel? What do we have here? And then we build on it. Demons, by the way, do come from daimons. So the two words have the same root, but the daimon becomes transformed if you change your universe, your worldview, shall we say, from what I've just been describing, and instead have a worldview that is a cosmic battlefield between good and evil. And so if you're not with us, you're against us. And any troublemakers, well, they must be on the evil side. And so as I mentioned, daimons are very troublesome. And so within the later Christian context, a binary opposition, you're either on the good side or the bad side, so daimons must be on the bad side, and they became the demons. I think, to our loss, to look at it that way, because according to the theurgic side, without establishing better relationship with the daimons than demonizing them, our spiritual growth is quite inhibited. And so this is a treasure. I think this mm-hmm. is a kind of insight that is not old or out of date. I think it's something that we have to consider in the sense that, so the fear, just as a sort of playfully put, the activity of fear, gee, we can think of manifesting in creativity and curiosity.
Mm-hmm.
The daimonic manifests in our lives often as our obsessions, mm. as our attachment to material things.
Right.
And we know what kind of trouble we can get into
mm-hmm.
there.
Mm-hmm.
But that is part of the cosmic creation return. It can't yeah. happen without the immaterial, at least in one phase of this great circuit, being oriented toward the material.
Mm-hmm.
And so the problem is we get caught and we forget that it's part of something, and we become obsessed with our desires and our fears and our angers, our reaction to these material things,
mm-hmm.
and then we go crazy. And that's the daimon. That's daimonic activity. What is the solution? The solution, again, is not to damn these attachments, but to put them in the proper context.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And, of course, part of the context is there is a release. There's an attachment, but there's also a release. And the release can't happen without dealing with the daimons, not just trying to exorcise them or pretend we're not having those feelings or those attachments, but, in fact, identifying this as daimonic, understanding that its essence is not evil and not troublesome, but part of the larger swirl.
Right.
And then getting to know the daimons, figuring out what their role is, perhaps what they really want, which is not necessarily to stall the circuit at all, because they're part of it too.
Mm-hmm.
And then on we go. And so.
So we have the communion of all things, and so theogists would understand that you have to facilitate conversation with the different energetics of this. And so when you were talking about the luminosity, the differences of light and of energy, so as a medium, I perceive things as light with that luminosity. There's a special luminosity when spirit is visiting, and they all have a distinct energetic signature. So that is unique to them, and that human souls have a distinct vibratory force. It's like if we're talking on a spectrum of energy and also light, versus how an angel would feel in connection with their light, their particular luminosity and their vibrational frequency. So yeah, I could see the relationship with theurgy. In these contexts.
I have no doubt you're a theurgist, Willa. I mean, I'm sure that this is, at its best, what mediumship must be.
Mm-hmm.
And, yes, these phenomena of light, of luminosity, certainly goes through the ages. It's just so rare to find the level of detail that
mm-hmm.
we find
in
some of the writings of the Amplicus. So.
Mm-hmm.
And because they're kind of more than one way to divide the pie, so to speak,
mm-hmm.
Should stop us from getting too rigid and saying, there's only seven. there's not eight and there's not six. It has to be get sort of orthodox about it. Because, again, it's all as it manifests to us. And at the level at which we are receptive, and different people are receptive at different levels. I imagine this makes sense to you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and there is a responsiveness energetically to that spirit world, not just, and I would include our earthly world has that dimensional sharing, that goes on between the different dimensions, between the different energetics that are going on with this. And the essence, connecting with the essence, gives you more clarity into that person's or that, I guess we think of them as people, right? We think of them the loved ones we've passed as people. And to some extent, we almost feel like that way about angels, too. So there's a personification. So when you're talking about the daemons, it's D-A-E, correct?
In Latin, I'm using it in the Greek, which would be translated to D-A-I.
D-A-I, okay. Just to make that distinction for it. With those, are they sometimes an essence, or do they have a distinct personality?
Well, that's a deep question.
I just had to ask. If you know.
I've struggled with this for a long time,
yeah.
Because a lot of my background is science, and the idea of personification, in psychological science too,
yeah.
I mean, a lot of the notion of personification is that it's a sort of projection,
mm-hmm.
A pure projection, in fact.
Yeah.
You know, those primitive people or those little children, when they think the wind or the tree is a person, we should outgrow that, right? I've struggled with this idea of personification for a long time, you know, personally. And at this point, sort of look at the question of, is it really a person or is it really an impersonal force, is the wrong question.
Okay.
For one thing, it's really unanswerable. We are operating from where we are. And so in a sense, personification isn't a projection, it's a choice in the kind of relationship we have. So we can relate to everything as dead, right? You could choose to see me as a meat puppet, you know, some kind of protoplasmic thing in a bag of skin.
Mm-hmm.
We can choose to deanimate the world entirely and see it all in terms of, let's say, dead physics and dead chemistry. That's a choice. We can also choose to experience the world as fully animated. How do we choose between the two? We'll try them on, see what happens,
right.
And what kind of a world unfolds and what happens to ourselves when we do that. And so sometimes I talk about a thing called the scale of depth. And one pole of the scale of depth is basically, and the scale of depth is a scale of relationships, ways that we can relate to other things. And so one extreme end of the pole is the it pole. We can relate to everything as an object, everything as simply kind of flat. But then we might tune into the sense of depth that whatever, I'm quoting now the old group called the Incredible String Band from the 1970s for the ancient hippies out there. There's a lyric in their song, whatever you think, it's more than that,
mm-hmm.
which I've always loved.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
the truth is, whatever we focus on, not just objects of thought, but objects of perception, objects of impulse and fantasy, etc., whatever kind of objects we're talking about, if we really pay attention, there's always more
mm-hmm.
than the appearance, always more that's being presented, and that's the depth. If we go a little bit deeper in the scale of depth, we'll get the sense that not only does that, whatever it is we're focusing on, have a kind of interiority, but it has an interior life.
Mm-hmm.
There's something resonating in me as a living being, as an ensouled being, that's resonating with the interior of that. So we go from object to depth, to a kind of sense of life. We go a little bit deeper. We sense that it's not just a life force,
mm-hmm.
but there's something a little more specific going on. There's an entity. If we go even deeper than that, then we start approaching the possibility of engagement, of actually having some kind of mutual relationship with that entity. We go a little bit deeper, then we're starting to get into the zone of communion,
right.
where we're starting to sense that entity in some important way inside myself and me in some important way inside that.
Mm-hmm.
And so we're heading toward the communion of all things at that point. So personification as projection, very popular in kind of reductionist approaches,
mm-hmm.
and very useful within certain contexts, without
right.
a doubt. But again, within certain contexts, it's not childish to relate to the world in terms of persons. it is the essence of the worldwide way of relating called animism, for example, which we find everywhere as far back as we can look, and all different forms of theisms. Even so-called monotheism, as you've already noted, has angels and archangels, and and certainly within spiritualism, and this is something I think is more developed in spiritualism than in ancient theurgy, the level of the departed souls. Very little in the surviving material about theurgy on that. We have souls and heroes, but not a whole lot about what my sense is spiritualist mediums often are tapping into. Is that more immediate level there?
So, so how does iambiquus suggest that people then relate? Does he has the diagram, a bit of the hierarchy of energetics there. Are there any suggestions of having that communion with those various levels?
There are practices. There's a whole set of actual activities that ancient theurgists would do. And again, the record is so fragmented that we don't have step-by-step instructions for this. But we certainly know that purification practices of various kinds were involved, cleansing, certainly meditation and contemplation of some very profound forms. If there's one fragment of the Chaldean oracles I would draw to people's attention, it is the single longest surviving fragment in the usual collection of the Chaldean oracles fragments. It's actually fragment number one. So it's easy to find. It's on page one. And it's fragment number one simply because it's the longest one. And it's a very profound meditation text describing a certain way of focusing the attention, which largely is what I just described in terms of the scale of depth, actually. So a meditation practice there. Also relating to material objects in special ways.
Okay.
And this would probably have been done in a ritual context, but again, the record is fuzzy there. But certainly the idea that because we're talking about emanation from one to many, that link is not broken. And so in a certain sense, the one remains present or available in some sense in the many.
Mm-hmm.
So every one of these seemingly discrete objects actually has a spiritual function. And the way it's often put is to use the notion of memory, that we never entirely forget our origin in unity. We might lose track of it consciously because we're so razzle-dazzled by all of the clinging and freaking out, but deep down inside there's still a faint trace memory there. And the thing about a memory is that often memories emerge because of cues, you know, what psychologists often call recall cues. So I'm walking down the road and suddenly I smell someone's baking an apple pie and suddenly I'm back in my grandmother's kitchen. You know, when she used to do this and the feelings flood back, etc.
Mm-hmm.
Simple recall cue. And theurgy is taught that there are objects throughout the cosmos, deliberately sown throughout the cosmos, that can act as very powerful recall cues. And so the idea is that we encounter these and we use them as our prompts to recollect. It's very interesting, the notion of, or the feeling of nostalgia. I mentioned Grandma's kitchen, so suddenly I think we're all nostalgic for a moment for something.
Sure, I want it. I want the apple pie.
There you go. And the one. I'll have one piece, please. And the idea of a spiritual nostalgia, this inkling, the sense of more to it. Most people are familiar with the memory phenomenon called déjà vu. In French, already seen, when we have an experience and it's like, oh, that's kind of weird. You know, it's a, haven't I experienced this before, or something like that. And there's a related phenomenon also called in French, presque vu, almost seen, sort of tickle. It can be almost an irritation sometimes.
Yeah.
You see the beautiful cathedral spire with the sun setting behind it, and you're stirred. There's a sense that there's a revelation here, and it's just beyond my comprehension. is there, but I can't quite get it. All these things can be regarded as forms of spiritual nostalgia, a little stirring within the soul. And the word for this, by the way, is the one in the soul. That Iamblichus wrote that length about the one in the soul.
The one in
and we want to stir that by the use of these retrieval cues or these recall cues. Now, these can actually be formally assembled into collections of these cues and would be used in some sense ritually. Apparently, they would create images of various deities. So, for example, Hecate, who's quite central to the theurgical revelation, you would create an actual carven image of Hecate and incorporate in the carving or perhaps within the core of the carving various objects connected to that goddess. And then, in some kind of ritualistic way, invite the presence of Hecate into this collection of recall cues.
Mm-hmm.
And this could trigger some movement in the return of the current. It could take us back to at least certain levels on the way back to the one. And ultimately, my sense is that if we want to talk about what you might want to call theurgical enlightenment or full maturation of theurgy, we end up that the entire cosmos is one great big retrieval cue to stir this spiritual nostalgia to such a brilliant form that the universe becomes transparent to the one. And that is that. The theurgist, her or himself, becomes a living, walking retrieval cue for others. Because again, the theurgist in their actions, in their thoughts, and etc., is manifesting this current. And so this is where the teaching and the inspiration comes in, is that the theurgist actually becomes a living reminder of this, at least the possibility of this cosmic transparency. So the universe becoming a recall cue, the theurgist becoming a recall cue. That's where it's at.
Yeah. Oh, this is fantastic. Yeah, this recall cue thing is just, I'm just so savoring this. I'm in, so, you know, what comes to mind as you're saying these things, that, you know, people find comfort in, let's say, an image of Mother Mary or an image of the Dalai Lama or a guru, and Jesus, and they have that that representation, and those become like recall cues to some extent in them. And do you feel that there is a part of this is a connection with archetypes, that archetypes also play a role in that recall?
This would be a theurgical take on Jungian psychology. You could do
yes.
It.
Okay.
I mean, you could use the notion of archetypes as identical, in fact, with what I'm describing as retrieval cues.
Right.
That there is a specific term for this, by the way, for those who want to get a little more serious in the digging of it. You know, what I'm calling a retrieval cue in the old text is referred to by this Greek word synthema, which transliterated looks like S-U-N, like sun, T-H-E-M-A. So these retrieval cues are, in the old text, referred to as synthemata. And indeed, if you look at the history of Christian iconography, one quickly becomes aware of a lot of fighting and a lot of tension around the role of religious imagery in Christianity. When you look at the Eastern Orthodox history, for example, there's an alternation between the iconoduals and the iconoclasts. Some people saying that the icons had religious value, and others came along saying they're idols, right? And we have to get rid of them, get rid of you as well, if you like them. And even in also in the Western, in Latin, et cetera, the Western branch, we have often iconic traditions. Some traditions go into a Roman Catholic church that's loaded with the imagery and all of that kind of thing, go into the Swedish Protestant church and it's bare. You know, there's almost nothing there. You might get a cross if you're lucky, but the walls are white, and it's very, very stark.
Yes.
And so this is the residue of this age-old back and forth between the spiritual opportunity versus the spiritual danger of images.
Mm-hmm.
And so obviously we know what side the theurgical Christian would be on, seeing the value and also the danger.
Mm-hmm.
Because, again, you know, we are human. This was an important point that even in the ancient Platonism, which we haven't gotten into perhaps for good reason, but there they weren't always on the same page. And we have Iamblichus, whom I've mentioned, and another important ancient Platonic philosopher who's even better known than Iamblichus, named Plotinus.
Mm-hmm.
And Plotinus said that the human soul is not completely in this world. There's a little part of, like a little tentacle of the human soul still way up in the divine realm, and that's kind of how it is. And the Iamblichus disagreed. He said, no, we're actually here. We really are here. There is no sort of little tentacle thing. I mean, we're part of the circuit, etc. But if we get into saying, well, we're not entirely human, we're not entirely here,
mm-hmm.
it's almost like a disagreement in terms of method rather than a one of substance, because I think the disagreement is more to do with the dangers of different presentation.
Mm-hmm.
So Iamblichus argued the danger of this notion that we aren't fully here is that, therefore, here is no good, right? We should reject all of this and get to that.
Mm-hmm.
And that fundamentally is not what Iamblichus and I think what theurgy was aiming on. Let's not pretend in any way that we're not fully human. Let's not pretend in any way that we're not fully embodied, we're not fully incarnated.
Mm-hmm.
That's where we need to start, because that's where we actually are. And any premature turning away from that is highly problematic. And so there is no turning away from the material world in the theurgical vision.
Mm-hmm.
It has to be fully part of everything else. There may be more to it, but there is it,
mm-hmm.
and we are it. That's where we have to, where we really have to start.
Beautiful.
But obviously, that's where the retrieval cues are. They're right here.
Yeah.
If we say, we have to get into some very strange, elevated thing and go to some high astral plane to find anything useful, then we're missing the gift.
That's right, in front of us. Yes.
What is this embodiment then? You know, is it really a prison cell? Is this really a mistake that somebody made? No. This is it. This is where we are. This is what's given to us. But it is interesting how theurgy actually is part of the origin of the Christian traditions in an intriguing way, because obviously the whole ancient polytheistic world went down with the political rise of Christianity in the 4th century. Iamblichus was alive at the beginning of the 4th century. Interestingly, we think his year of death was 325, which in Christian history is gigantically important. That is the year where the first Council of Nicaea met to begin to kind of crystallize the notion of an Orthodox Christian worldview. It took a long time to gel, but the first Council of Nicaea is regarded as really quite foundational in terms of narrowing down what is allowed in terms mm-hmm. of the Christian vision. By the time we get to toward the end of the same century, the 4th century, we have Christian emperors who have outlawed not just pagan beliefs, but any other Christian beliefs than their favorite, right? And so Theodosius, the Emperor Theodosius, said, this church is, in the Greek word, is Catholicos, which means universal. Means mm-hmm. everybody has to see it this way, right? And we'll destroy your temples, we'll kill your priestesses, etc. And so, sadly, all of that did unfold. And that's why we have very little trace of the old theurgical writings and why most of the Iamblichus was gone, etc., etc. It was targeted. It was deliberately erased as one of the great threats to this narrowed definition of Christianity. But it wasn't the end. You know, history is full of these fun little back doors. So go a couple hundred years later, and we have a fellow who took the author's name, Dionysius. He was a Christian, and he wrote some books that became very, very influential. And effectively, he took the Anglican theurgy and reworked it for the purposes of Catholic theology and Catholic Church. So we have the notion of the cosmos as the synthema, the cosmos as the retrieval cue. He took that and said, well, it's not the cosmos, it's just the Church. The Church synthema. The rest of it is something else, it's the creation, but you better not regard that as the thing. It's just the Church is the retrieval cue. All those spiritual entities, we know, you have the nine choirs of angels and all of that, comes from the writings of Dionysius. Where did he get it from? The Amblicus, right? And so the schemes that I've been laying out here in terms of the different levels of spiritual entities were turned into the angels and archangels of Orthodox Christian theology coming through Dionysius. That's not the end of the story either. We have in the Italian Renaissance this wonderful reorientation toward ancient wisdom, particularly in places like Florence in the 15th century. And a fellow that I'm very interested in, a man named Marsilio Ficino, who lived in Florence, and he was the most important person to bring back a lot of this ancient wisdom. He was the person who translated the Amblicus for the first time from Greek into Latin, making it more accessible. He was the first person in many, many centuries to translate all the works of Plato from Greek into Latin to make it more accessible. And it's apparent that Ficino became a theurgist. He became a Christian theurgist. And this caused him, I'm sure, sleepless nights because he wasn't just a Christian. He was a Roman Catholic priest. Mm. And so obviously quite committed and quite devout by all evidence to that Orthodox version of things. He really had a deep intuition about the profound value of the writings of Iamblichus, for example. Mm-hmm. And so it's fascinating to look at the tension in the work of Ficino, trying to reconcile the obvious value of this tradition coming to him in a polytheistic context and this other precious way of looking at things coming to him from a monotheistic context. He also had to watch out for the Inquisition.
Yeah.
About all of this. So anyway, I could go on all day.
And I kind of want you to, but I know. This is great.
More people. The reason I love sharing this is that I'm just convinced that I'm not alone. I know I'm not alone, but those few of us who have sort of found this and find it enriching, but more people were exposed to it, more people would be turned on as well. And so, I do love sharing this, and I thank you very much for giving me a chance to natter at our viewers.
It's been wonderful. You bring such a wealth of information, and you have such a wonderful way of sharing and making it accessible to all of us, so that history comes alive and we can see parallels with our own understandings and our own energy. So I can't thank you enough for being on the show today, Leonard. This has been wonderful. And this is just a toe dip in the water, folks, in terms of understanding theurgy. And I think those that are watching this really may want to watch this again. I know this is one I'm going to watch myself again. So is there any little pieces of information that I may have missed? I really think this is a great archival video to understand about theurgy and to see the parallelisms with spiritualism. So I know you had some books in mind if people were interested in following up with this.